This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When Tashni DuBroy graduated from Shaw University, she had no idea that just more than a decade later, she would become president of her alma mater. She did not set out to build a career in academia. Growing up in Jamaica, she developed the same entrepreneurial spirit that her parents had when they created several businesses, including a hair salon. After getting her Ph.D. in chemistry at NC State, she went to work for one of the world's largest chemical companies, and she combined her memories of her mother's hair concoctions from their salon with her chemistry knowledge to build her own successful line of hair products. She returned to the university campus for what she thought would be a short stint in teaching at Shaw, but she quickly rose in the administration, and in June of last year, she was appointed to lead the South's oldest HBCU. Tashni DuBroy is the 17th president of Shaw University in Raleigh, and she joins me now on the State of Things. Tashni DuBroy, what an honor. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
I want to talk about your experience at Shaw, certainly, but I want to take you back to growing up in Jamaica. What was that like?
Growing up in Jamaica was a fun experience. You know, I constantly think about it as being an island girl. I carefree. I'm very carefree, and I still have that kind of trait to this day. It's having a no problem man kind of attitude, and it helps me in the way that I approach problems. Sometimes, when others get really stirred up in the face of adversity, I tend to be a lot calmer, and it allows me to focus. Jamaica is a beautiful country, so you know it's beautiful to be able to live in a place where people come to vacation. Not only does it have a rich culture, you know, with reggae and Bob Marley being our most significant ambassador, but also, you know, just the landscape itself. It's very diverse and, you know, growing up near the beach always made for a beautiful time.
And helped you be carefree. But you say carefree, but I understand also studious. You paid a lot of it. You loved school.
Most definitely. I am probably one of the coolest nerds out there. Yeah. No other way to describe it. But my parents placed a very high value on education. So my mom often brags that she's never had to tell me to study. But, you know, I often laugh about that because she didn't have to tell me because the nuns were. I went to a Catholic school.
Oh, there you go.
So, you know, they were really strict on having study hall. And so those habits were ingrained in me at a very early age. And so I never departed from it.
Well, I would say also having had nuns in my earliest education, there are ways around them. So you apparently chose not to do that. You
I
took
did.
The straight and narrow.
Listen, Jamaican nuns are very different.
Maybe they're tougher
Frank.
Than mine. No, we'll talk about that later. But talk about them because farmers and entrepreneurs, right?
That's right. Yeah. My parents are both farmers and entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurship is in my blood. You know, I grew up at my mom's restaurant. She was a caterer at one point in time and also owned a hair salon. And, you know, I grew up around these spaces where the bottom line was always talked about and customer service was at its optimum. They understood what it was like to treat the janitor the same way that you would a senator. You know, anybody that walked into the restaurant understood that they were going to get premier customer service. And I also understood what it meant to be fiscally conservative. My dad is stingy. There's no other way to describe it, but he's stingy. He pays attention to the bottom line. And he instilled values in me that to this day I haven't departed from. So understanding that, you know, there's no need to always wear branded clothing, you know, especially if your pocket can't afford it. You know, those are the things that you want to ensure that you're teaching your kids so that when they're older, they don't depart from it, except shoes. I tend to have a shoe problem here.
A little fancy when it comes to shoes. Well, that's perfectly right. Another way that you can make margin if you're a business person
yes.
and you're watching the bottom line is to control your supply, right?
That is correct.
And your wholesale prices. One way to do that is to make your own hair product.
That's correct.
Your mother did, and apparently you were the test subject.
Yes. Oh, I tell you. So I was the conventional lab rat back home. I had a thick head of hair, and so I was a prime client for my mom. She would go into the backyard and pick aloe vera. She would use mayonnaise and eggs to make a conditioner. And, you know, as a kid, I didn't realize how significant that would become in my later years. But it turns out that when I became a chemist and when I had this passion that I developed for hair care, everything that my mom would do, I now ended up having to translate in a laboratory setting. So using extracts from certain teas and certain plants, you know, this was what I was now having to do to infuse in the formulations for hair care products. So it's so funny how life has a way of coming full circle, and I appreciated every moment of it.
Now, when she's experimenting on you, she's using organic material, so eggs and mayonnaise and oils and things.
Yes.
She's not finding things in
that's
chemical
right.
plant somewhere.
Exactly.
So you were safe.
No,
you were always safe. You were always safe, but you learned the sense that, yeah, you can experiment. And how wonderful would it be to go back and say, oh, what was the chemical makeup? Why would that work? Why would that have worked so well?
That's right.
And it certainly worked for her business. Now, your career in chemistry may not have been what it is today, now that you have a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
Given your first 8 years in school, you didn't like chemistry that much.
Oh, I did not. I when I first had my, you know, ninth grade chemistry experience, I could not understand the concept of a mole.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I was having a tough time with the subject because, you know, in the introductory parts of chemistry, after learning about measurements, then you've got to tackle that the mole concept. But my ninth grade chemistry teacher, Miss McCoy, was outstanding. She realized that I was having a tough time. And after going to her and, you know, complaining about the subject matter and saying it didn't make any sense, she said to me, you know, Tashni, you have a mental block against chemistry. And once you get past that mental block, you will be able to understand the subject, you know, fully. And at the time, I was about 13 or so. In Jamaica, we go to school a bit earlier. I was about 13, and I remember, you know, it's almost the rolling of the eyes, but you can't really do it in front of the teacher because you're like, you know, what is a mental block and why do I have it and how do I get rid of it, right? But I processed it internally, and what I ended up doing was going to different books to read what a mole was. And it was on a summer vacation to the United States that I remember going to Barnes & Noble and getting a book, and it had the definition or an analogy, plain as day. It said a dozen is 12 items and a mole is 6.02 times 10 to the 23 items. And it was just the way that they had it. In simplistic terms, you know, it clicked.
But two things that shouldn't be lost in the story. Number one, when you had a problem with chemistry as a 13-year-old girl, you didn't just walk away from it or blame someone. You thought, well, let's talk to the teacher about this and see if there's a way to fix it.
That's correct.
And then actually took it on yourself to figure out a way to find a way around this block.
For sure. That can only be created from a parent who is interested in the character that of a child. And my parents were certainly building my character from a very, very early age.
And you weren't expecting to have a career in chemistry. This is just one subject you didn't want to have to blow,
exactly.
Right?
That's right.
That's cool. So you left Jamaica for college, right? You went to community college in New York?
I did. I started at Kingsborough Community College. And there's a story behind that, too. I was a smart kid, and I think the theme of adversity probably plays a part here. I remember I didn't know much about the university system in the United States. What you really hear as an international student is about Harvard and Yale and Brown and all of the branded universities and the Ivies. And so I'd applied to them, and I didn't get in. And, you know, there are multiple reasons for that. Probably my essay was weak. Who knows? But what happened was I had gotten into the University of the West Indies in Jamaica. And the other university that I got into was Kingsborough Community College, because I also applied to the CUNY system. My mom was living in New York at the time. And I remember we researched Kingsborough Community College. We learned about what junior colleges were and, you know, the difference in stature compared to four-year colleges. And I took it like a champ. I said, Mom, you know what? I'll do my best there. And then after 2 years, I'll apply somewhere else. And after working at Kingsborough for 1.5 years, I was valedictorian of the community college. And it was something that my mom needed. It was something that
Were they worried that you weren't going to that you weren't going to Harvard?
No, I think it was more of a situation where my parents had separated. Mm-hmm. And so she had invested so much in me, and she felt as if she had failed me, you know, as a parent. And so I think it was affirmation that I would be okay.
Is that something you think now looking back, or did you have some sense of that responsibility?
I had some sense of it at that time. So I knew that it would help to change her mindset, knowing that I would be okay, you know, that their separation had not affected me in such a negative manner that I would not have focused on my schoolwork.
This move would have had meant a lot of changes for you, leaving Jamaica for New York. Among them, the climate. You experienced snow for the first time. And
yes.
There's a story there.
That's right. I was sitting in Barnes & Noble on, I think, 69th Street near Lincoln Center, waiting for my mom to get off work. And I vividly remember reading a book there and the attendant coming up to me. And she said, "Excuse me, are you Tashni Coote?" That was my maiden name at the time. And I looked at her quizzically because I didn't want to talk to any strangers. And I was about 17 at the time. And I said, "Yes," in a hesitant manner. And she said, "This may seem weird, but your mom called and she said you should go outside right now because it's snowing and you've never seen snow before." And it was totally embarrassing for a teenager, right? But I was ecstatic. Yeah. I was excited inside. I went out, no umbrella, no nothing. I didn't know what the precipitation would feel like. So I was soaking wet by the end of my walk in Manhattan.
It's a great story. There are many more to come as we continue our meet today. Tashni Dubroy is president of Shaw University in Raleigh. We'll get more about her work and her life on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Tashni Dubroy is my guest today. She is president of Shaw University in Raleigh. And so we got you to New York from Jamaica. And then after community college, one of your sisters convinced you to move to Raleigh, right?
That's right. So my sister, Peta Gay, she was going to Shaw University at the time. And I had never been to North Carolina. And I was then in New York trying to decide what I was going to do next. She convinced me to come to Raleigh because she said it was just like Jamaica. Now, you've got to remember, Frank, this was now the year 2000 or so. Mm-hmm. And when I got off the Amtrak train, I said to her, "Come on, you know, what on earth made you say that, you know?" But as I spoke with her, I understood why. It was a Southern hospitality, the people. You know, in New York, you walk by anybody on campus and nobody says hello. But at Shaw at that time, everybody would say hi to each other. And the same thing in the city, you know, we would always say hello. And so I got it. And I fell in love with Raleigh.
And, you know, we have some pretty nice beaches.
We
not
do.
In Raleigh.
Exactly. But not in Raleigh, but they're close by. That's right. I agree.
So you did. You went to Shaw. What was that like? What were you doing there? And how was that experience for you?
I was studying chemistry. It was my first time learning about an HBCU. And I went primarily because my sister was going there. And not only that, but they had a Jamaican president at the time who was interested in increasing the international student population. So he had heard of my success at Kingsborough Community College and his staff convinced me that it would be a good fit. And it was. Shaw is a very nurturing environment. I really enjoyed my time there. It was interesting to learn about the fraternities and sororities. And see them do their stepping. Homecoming experience was new for me. And just the culture, you know, understanding the American culture coming up from Jamaica was rich.
It seems to me there are a lot of currents that run through an HBCU in terms of understanding American history and American culture, the need for an HBCU and how it operates in this culture. But as someone who comes from the outside, what was your experience of it and what was your thought about the theory of an HBCU going in, and how did you experience it through your time at Shaw?
You know, I'll be honest with you. As a young student, I did not process it in the manner that I do today. And so for me, it was going into an environment that I knew would help to give me the knowledge that I would need to in order to be successful in my further academic pursuits. But I can say that it was a rich experience, especially since I've gone to both predominantly white institutions and to HBCUs. It's just a different cultural journey. And I think there is beauty to be appreciated in both.
You did leave that environment to take an internship at a certain point at NC State in chemistry. Is that right?
That's correct.
How did that, I mean, were you clear on a career in chemistry in your undergrad, or did the internship in any way affect
Final decision? I've been a chemist since ninth grade. I always knew that I wanted to be a chemist. But the manner in which I had processed it was that I was going to be a chemistry professor. After graduating from NC State University with a PhD in physical organic chemistry, I'd called Shaw to ask them if they had any positions. And the reason I called Shaw is because of the universities that I'd gone to, I realized that they needed my talent the most. You know, I wanted to be able to invest in young people, in particular minorities, because I know that when you have talented faculty, they tend not to go back to HBCUs, and I didn't want to do that. I really knew that Shaw needed my help, but they didn't have a position at the time. So serendipitously, I applied to BASF for a position, and I got it. But I would say that that was probably one of the very best things that could have happened to me in my professional career. BASF is an amazing company, and they'd given me so many great opportunities to traverse the chemical industry. I played multiple roles, not only as a bench chemist, but I was introduced to the business side of the company, and that was absolutely outstanding for me, especially as a young chemist coming to the industry.
And you did get your PhD at State, right?
That's correct.
NC State.
Yes.
And that's really where I understand where you developed, because you talked about yourself being a nerd, pretty dedicated, devoted to the books. NC State social life. You develop a social life.
Oh, yes, I did. Now, listen, NC State knows how to party. I tell you that. At Shaw, even though the students were very adept at partying, I was not a socialite. You know, I would participate in, you know, cultural activities. I'd be on the yard when they're having step shows. But I wasn't involved to a certain extent because I was so focused on graduating and I wanted to graduate at the top of my class. And so, you know, I made my studies the focal point of my experience there. But when I went to NC State, grad school will kick your butt. So you definitely have to learn how to create an outlet. And that outlet was, you know, going downtown on Hillsborough Street, rather, with my peers. And I drank my first beer while at NC State University. Can we say beer on this program?
You can.
Okay, I can.
And I think you've just generated a bumper sticker that will live forever.
That's good marketing for you.
That sounds great. So, and I also love the fact that while you're getting your undergrad at Shaw, you really have to keep your nose to the grindstone. But finally, when you're getting your PhD, you can let loose a little bit.
Exactly. And that's exactly what it was. I felt as if, you know, I had come to a point where I could breathe a little bit. Yeah. And and so I did. So I was still, you know, focused on writing my thesis, understanding the physical organic chemistry concepts a bit more. But it really just gave me some time to relax.
And you met your husband there.
That is correct. I did. So while at NC State, a friend of mine who is an unofficial matchmaker introduced me to my husband.
So there you go. Meanwhile, you said you wanted to go back to Shaw. They didn't have a position for you after you graduated. So then you went into industry. You worked for BASF. And that was in Houston, right?
That's correct. I started off in Houston in the heat of Texas. And then I got moved to the business side in New Jersey, working at their BASF Catalyst headquarters, and then went on to BASF Corp back in Florham Park, New Jersey.
So tell us how all of that happened. You started out as a bench chemist, right?
Yes. I was working on what's called Ziegler-Natta catalysts. Our UNC audience will understand that, some of them at least. And I was doing...
See, a list of cats, apparently, that then get posted on YouTube. No, forgive me. Forgive me. So you're working on catalysts for BASF.
Yes.
But you're sort of... It's a kind of an assembly line job
for
in some
sure.
ways, right?
That's right. You know, I was in the research lab. So I was doing... development work, trying to see what catalysts had the greatest activity, and these have functionality in plastics, the plastics industry. And while there, a VP of the business came down to the catalyst site, and he said to me, "Hey, you know, what is it that you want to do with your career? How do you see yourself moving up in BASF? And it was an interesting question, and he wanted me to do a presentation for him. And so I turned that presentation into something totally different. Not only did I tell him what I wanted to do with my career, but I also told him what kind of opportunities BASF had to gain market share. And to hear a chemist talking about market share and, you know, business development, I think he was intrigued by that and he wanted to support me. And so he gave me an opportunity to work in one of the premier groups at BASF Catalyst, and it was called the Global Technology Analysis Group. It was where I learned process optimization.
And you weren't just sort of answering his question while he's passing through the shop. You actually made a full presentation,
that's correct.
Right?
Yes.
On this, how long had those ideas, both the answer to the question, what do you want to do with yourself, and the other question, what could BASF do to improve market share, how long had those ideas been percolating in your mind?
It started the instant that I stepped foot on the Catalyst site back in Texas. My mind works in that manner. It's always, you know, how do I make things better? Quite in tune with BASF's mantra. But I always want to understand what it is that I'm working on. So I actually break down the pieces and then put them right back together. It's just the way in which my brain processes info. And so prior to that VP coming down, I had already gone to all of the salespeople. I had toured the site, every area of the site. I had gone and spoken to people who were working there, not only in manufacturing, but in the analytics part of it, the research lab, the business development. And I had asked them fundamental questions. I never think that there's a stupid question. And so I asked them, hey, the sales guys, I said, what is it like to sell a catalyst? Is it like selling a car? You know, I just wanted to get the real, human response. I wanted a simple response to each of those types of questions. And then it got more complex when I had to speak to researchers. But I documented it in a journal. And it's where one of those things where luck meets opportunity, right? And so when the VP came down to me and asked me that, I could have just answered him by saying, this is what I'd want to do with my career. But I knew that that's not a Tashney answer, right? And so I was able to give him quite a bit of the information that I had already researched.
It sounds to me, though, like your first inquiries, as you're kind of walking around asking these questions, had to do with kind of helping you get your head around your own job. In other
that's
words,
right.
What am I making here? And well, then where does it go?
Exactly.
And all of that. At what point do you start to realize that BASF is missing some opportunities? And what were those? What are your suggestions, or were they at the time?
Well, I always want to know how I can add value. And the reason why I started to think about value prop and where the opportunities were is because BASF had recently acquired BASF Catalyst, which was prior to that was Engelhardt. And Engelhardt was not number one in the market. So Basel and other entities were ahead of us. So if you're not number one, then you have areas to be improved. And that was my thought process at the time, saying, all right, so we're not number one. How do we get there? And those were some of the ways that I thought in which we should get there. And that's what I had explained to him.
And what was your answer to the question, where do you want to be in 5 years? Or how do you
Told him that I'd wanted to be on the business side of the company. Mm-hmm. I'd wanted to exercise the entrepreneurial part of my brain. And that's exactly what he did. He accelerated a 5-year career plan into about a year.
So you moved up the corporate ladder. What position then were you holding?
Initially as a research chemist, and then secondly as a global technology analyst.
At what point does it occur to you that since you've got all these great ideas about business, you should start your own?
Ooh, so I've always wanted to start my own business. As a matter of fact, I've started many businesses that were not registered with any government entity. No federal tax ID numbers, but I had employees, okay? And they were my brothers and sisters and my friends. But, you know, as a kid, I was well known for my entrepreneurship, and didn't do any lemonade stands. What I actually did was I made pom-poms. So back home, we didn't have that many shops or you know, pharmacies, Walmarts, nothing like that, that were selling prefab.
That's not yet another reason to move to Jamaica, but go ahead.
So no prefab pom-poms. So what I did was I went to the plastics factory and I would ask them for their rejected plastic. And on sports day at, you know, any event that my high school had, I was known for my pom-poms. I would sell them to cheerleaders, sell them to people in the stands.
And are you hiring people to help you manufacture them too?
Oh, for sure. My friends would do that. Yeah, so they'd get a cut of it. And I sold everything. I sold juices because my cooler was cooler than everybody else's. When I went to the States, I was glad to have the opportunity to do that. My parents would come up on summer vacation and I would buy Lisa Frank folders and sell them back home in Jamaica. I'd buy hair bands. Listen, Frank, whatever it was that I could afford, I would sell it and I'd make a profit. So I knew what that concept was like.
What it was. And it occurs to you at some point that hair care products would be now when you're at BASF, right?
Yes, that's
that
right.
Hair care?
So that was in its making while at NC State. I met a young lady who I would say has a similar spirit, entrepreneurial spirit, and her name is Dr. Tiffany Bailey Lash. We came from two totally different backgrounds. Tiffany's from Greensboro, North Carolina, and went to Hampton University, but we certainly shared a passion for hair care. And while at NC State University, in our spare time, you know, we would start concocting hair care products because these are things we wanted to actually use on our hair. So it would just be a pastime for us. And it's one of those things where you say it into the atmosphere. You know, you say, hey, you know, this is what we should do. We should start a hair care company. And as we started to research the hair care industry, we started to fraternize with people in the cosmetic science industry. And we went to the Society of Cosmetic Chemists as grad students. And they were so enamored with us because we had showed interest in an industry that many research scientists don't usually gravitate towards because, you know, they don't think of it as hard chemistry, right? It's a softer side of science. But we understood that there was a significant market in that realm. And Madam C.J. Walker, you know, African-American self-made millionaire, you know, she was making hair care products before it was even a popular industry to begin with. So we used her as inspiration. And when the time was right and we could actually afford it, we used our own money as seed capital. I actually got we won a business plan competition from Rutgers University, and that helped to accelerate the business. I've been a talker ever since my youth, so I was able to sell.
You also
company.
Used your mother as an inspiration, right? Did you
Most
go back
definitely.
To some of those concoctions she made and think, there's something to this?
It was not something that I did. It was something I did subconsciously because it wasn't until I was already in that I started remembering all of the things that my mom used to do. She certainly was an inspiration and still is because everything started to come together. You start thinking, man, this is familiar. You know, we did this back home. So, you know, all those pieces came together as well.
You were still working at BASF when you launched the company, right?
Yes.
Now, at a certain point, you had to make a choice. Isn't
That's
that
correct.
Right? So tell us about
You know,
that.
This is probably the more sobering part of my journey because at the time, it was a very tough decision to make. And it was a very serious part of my professional journey. I remember the HR coming to me and saying, you know, we know you own a hair care company. I just launched it and you did not disclose it to us. And now, you know, you've got to make a decision whether you want to stay with BASF or go and, you know, pursue your own business endeavors. And it was such a tough decision to make because my salary at BASF was what was really anchoring our family income. And I remember I made the decision after thinking about it. I'd made the decision and I told them I would stay at BASF. The night that I made that decision, I remember feeling sick to my stomach. It was as if I'd given up on a dream. I knew that it was not settling well with me. And I spoke it over with my husband. He said he would have supported me in whatever direction I'd gone. And so when I went back the next day to work, I went to my VP. She was in procurement at the time. And I apologize to her because, honestly, I'm very loyal. I don't like reneging, especially on huge decisions like the one that I had to make. But I had to apologize to her. And I said, you know, if I don't take this risk while I'm young, I feel I'll never be given this opportunity again. And so I went in the direction of entrepreneurship.
You did it. And you talked about your husband's support. Thank goodness for that beer at NC State. Just saying, it's really all keeps coming back.
Frank,
and getting
the interview is going downhill. We can't have beer twice in this conversation. Come on, Ryan.
It's got to be in the. It's good for your hair. Actually, my mother used to like use a hair. She used to use beer to do something with her hair.
Really?
I wonder what it was. Or maybe she just drank. I can't remember. I can't remember now. It was so long ago. You also have time for this. I think the brilliant and beautiful foundation that you started.
Yes.
Tell us
yes.
about that.
The Brilliant and Beautiful Foundation is a nonprofit that Tiffany and I co-founded. And it really came from us being asked to inspire young ladies at high schools, elementary schools, and it was a demand. So we had to formalize it. And so we started a 501(c). And it really means so much to me. You know, I get to do what's called shampoo labs. We created our shampoo labs. We would go into schools and, you know, kids come in thinking, all right, you know, we're about to make shampoo. And then you start throwing chemical nomenclature at them. Uh-huh. And you start saying, all right, you know, here is what a chemist can do and you can do it. And so we wanted to inspire young ladies. We just wanted to give them something fun that they could relate to their everyday lives. And at the same time, not even realizing that they were doing, hard sciences.
Great stuff. We're going to take a break right here. Tashni DeBroy is the president of Shaw University in Raleigh. She's my guest on The State of Things, and our conversation will continue in just a few moments. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today with Shaw University President Tashni DeBroy. So we talked about the difficult decision to leave BASF and to pursue your own career in your own business with hair care products. And then you've got a foundation where you sort of subversively teach chemistry through hair care.
Yes.
And that's terrific. Tea and Honey Blends Manufacturing led you back to North Carolina. Tell us how you came back to North Carolina.
That's correct. I had to start choosing where we would manufacture our hair care products. And it was a conversation that was intimately tied to what type of market did we want to capture. It turns out that there was a competitor called Carol's Daughter that had captured the New York market. And I was living in New Jersey when we were, you know, when it was time for us to start traversing that path. And so we said, all right, you know, she's up in the north, she's doing well, let's do it down south. And what better place to come back to than, you know, the part that looks just like Jamaica?
North Carolina, and your partner was from Greensboro, so that kind of helped.
Right,
right about that.
Did.
So what about Shaw? Then what led you back to Shaw, or did it?
While pursuing tea and honey blends, I had reached to a point where I thought it was time. I was poised to give back to the university, not only financially, but also from a talent perspective. I wanted students to understand that they could combine their love for chemistry with entrepreneurial endeavors. You know, I wanted them to understand that it was not a linear path. You didn't have to go into, you know, research science or professorship. And so I came back to teach at Shaw just so that they could have a very fun perspective of chem. And Shaw kept me every time that I would say, all right, you know, I think I've done my, you know, giving back to my alma mater here as far as a talent perspective. They would say, Dr. DeBroy, you know, I would love you to be the department chair. That was 3 months in to my position there at Shaw because my dean recognized that I had an MBA from Rutgers University and the PhD. And so she thought that the skill set would be a perfect match for being department chair. So I took it on and was successful at that position. And they just kept promoting me.
It was pretty fast.
It did. Unbelievably fast. As a matter of fact, I would say that I've broken some record, you know. But I really am a spiritual person, and I feel as if, you know, some amount of what it is that I've done, all of it actually, it's not a coincidence. It is certainly, if you believe in God, this is what you'd call destiny.
Tell us how you came to be president.
I served as department chair for about 3 years at the university and was responsible for doing a couple of things. I had to position my department, Department of Natural Sciences and Math, to become more electronically savvy, you know, and teaching from a digital perspective. We know how to do online curricula. So under my leadership, that occurred. Online documentation. So many of what we were doing was paper driven. So I had to position the department to lead the STEM faculty in that arena. And also accomplished cost savings. So we had so many professors, about 36 when I arrived, and it was deemed as too many, and I fully concurred. And so by the time I left as department chair, we had about 25, because it was now a more perfect match for the student faculty ratio. And then moving on from there, I was asked to serve as special assistant to the president for process optimization. And in this role, I led the university through a cost savings optimization charge.
That can be pretty painful.
Most definitely. It was probably one of the most painful professional positions I've ever had. But where I found the bulk of savings was in contractual negotiations. And so after negotiating contracts and saving the university about $2.5 million or so, I was nominated to be president of the institution. That came as quite a surprise to me. You know, that wasn't even on my radar, especially at such a young age. But as I said, whenever luck meets opportunity, I take advantage of it. And so I knew that I wanted to interview and I was going to give the interview my best shot. And by the time I got out of interviewing with the board, I still didn't know if I'd get the number of votes that I needed in order to serve as president. But, you know, the rest is history.
You weren't thinking about it going in, but once it became a possibility, your competitive nature
most definitely
just took over.
You know, I'm a scientist. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm driven. You know, so all of those types of character traits that started in my infancy were now put to work.
You were searching online how to do interviews, calling other universities.
Shamelessly, I'd admit
it. What did you learn in all of this, especially in your conversations with other presidents? What kind of things did you learn?
Well, one of the first things that I realized is that you have to have stellar recommendation letters. Mm. People have to believe in you. So one of the first people that I called up was Barbara Goodman at the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. And I said, you know, Barbara, I need your help. I said, you know, there are certain things that I need, for example, a recommendation letter, and not a soft recommendation letter that just says, you know, hey, Tashni is so good, she's nice, she's smart. No, it needed to be something more profound. And I was able to do that with multiple folks in the Raleigh Durham area because I'd already been networked with them. So it wasn't somebody that was new. This was really these were people who believed in me, who had interfaced with me while at Shaw, and they believed in my potential. And so I was able to get strong recommendation letters. Also from faculty. I had to ask faculty. I won't call their names now, but I had to ask faculty as well. And they were willing and able. Students, the same thing.
You are young, early to mid-30s.
Yes.
So, and were you worried that the board might think you're too young for the job?
Most definitely. I never thought I'd get the position because it within the cadre of applicants were other presidents, people who had presidential experience. But I think what the board recognized is that Shaw University could not go a traditional route. We had to go non-traditional and transformational, you know, if we want to be sustainable. And that was what it is that I was interviewing on. That was what you'd call my presidential campaign. I'm a bold leader. I have transformational ideas. I think as if there is no box. And I know that I can lead the university towards thinking like that. So much of what I currently do is changing the mindset of the organization. I have to start teaching the organization that we are valuable and we are valued by our external stakeholders, and they're getting it, and I love that.
Transformation, though, can be threatening to people who've been there for a long time, and you found that out very early on in your tenure.
That's right. On day two. But, you know, it didn't stop me because I'd always known that I'd come against, you know, I'd have a frictional journey at some points in time because people don't want to change. But what I'm having to do is get the organization to understand why we have to change. And usually, whenever the circumstances are so significant that they affect the bottom line, that's when people start saying, all right, we've got to have some changes.
Well, let's use this as an object lesson because the challenge that you met was with the band and the number of scholarships. And so we're looking at the cost of the university. Talk about that meeting and how it all turned out.
Well, you know, I started off by having meetings with our coaches. They were the first people that I approached about the swelling of costs in the athletics area. And that meeting went over well. You know, the coaches were very amenable to fixing some things. And as a matter of fact, they gave me ideas on where they saw the fat. And so, you know, coming in, it was very new to me to be able to have these types of conversations with a lot of type A personalities, right? You know, coaches want to win.
They're good at what they do.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. But I was very pleased with the outcome. And so I went on to have the conversation with the band director as well, because his area was another area where we were swelling and didn't have the monetary resources to back the scholarships that were being given away there. And it was more of a tuition discount rather than a scholarship. So when I had that conversation, I didn't know I was being taped, you know, but it really didn't matter, because I'm usually very, I'm very respectful in conversations. But I remember the day that we were talking, you know, the types of questions that he was asking me was more like to aggravate me. And I still have a Jamaican spirit in there somewhere. So, I'll never forget. I think the soundbite in my family for a couple of weeks was "try me." That was the soundbite that was played over and over. And they were like, "You said try me." I'm like, "Guys, come on here. You know, give me a break." They were like, "That's so Jamaican of you." And so, but you know, in the culture, it's really that I knew I was being tested. And so, yes, I may be 5'5", 125 pounds. But you know, at the end of the day, I have to remain very sound and bold in leadership. And sometimes you're going to have to make some tough decisions. And it's not going to be pleasing to everybody. But I had to unapologetically let the organization know that fiscal conservatism is my presidential campaign, and it will continue to be, because I don't want our donors thinking that they're pouring money into a black hole. So I have to be accountable to so many stakeholders, and our donors is one of them.
What are some of the, I mean, apart from that particular episode, what are some of the bigger challenges for you in administration?
One of the other things that I find is that so many times our faculty are tied to certain programs that they've had for such a long time. Shaw University has not had many changes in our academic curricula. And so that is what we're now doing. We are revamping the curriculum so that we can have programs that are more apropos or better fit with the workforce development that what the 21st century workforce is requesting. So that's one of the areas that we need to improve. And we need to work on customer service. Our students often complain about, you know, that person who isn't smiling or who sent them to 10 other people before they could get served. So internal customer service relations is certainly at the forefront of our thoughts. Alumni engagement is where we have to do a much better job. And so we've been working on that as well. And I have got to get out there and fundraise. You know, once I stepped into the position, I realized there was a $4 million gap, and I have been working and walking the pavement in order to bridge that gap. And honestly, Raleigh Durham has responded, but, you know, there's still more to do. And so I continue to seek the assistance of people of wealth in the community and, you know, state Shaw University's value proposition and why they should buy into my leadership.
What is the value proposition for Shaw and for HBCUs, do you think?
Well, Shaw University, the cornerstones of our strategy is technology, entrepreneurship, and sustainability. We want to become the school of choice for students who are interested in pursuing a career in technology fields. And we will become a premier institution, a force to be reckoned with, one that can compete with the likes of NC State, Duke, and UNC. So that's going to be our focal point. In particular, we'd like to increase the minority representation in these technology fields. It doesn't take long for you to read the news to hear about the lack of diversity at companies like Twitter and Google and Facebook and all else. So we think there's a niche there. And so I did an institutional audit when I came into the university, and what we found is that computer science was our strong suit, but we weren't marketing it. So we have an amazing department chair, Lloyd Williams, who's been able to place students into graduate programs. And his performance, the performance in the computer science department, just, you know, is outstanding. And so I realized with that asset that what we needed to do was develop the asset, you know, fund it, and gain a higher return on investment.
How much of this is developing relationships with businesses in the area, and how has that gone?
I'd say the majority of it relates to developing partnerships with technology entities here. That's why I love Shaw University's location, because we have a captive audience. All of the technology companies that are in the area, I think within the first month, I went out and met the CEOs because I wanted to ensure that they knew where Shaw University was, who its leader was, why they should invest in our students, and it has certainly worked. IBM funded our strategy. They have consultants that came on our campus to fund Vision Epic 2020, and Red Hat, Citrix, Fidelity Investments, Google, they've all captured our students, either given them jobs or internships. They've gone on for site tours. Employees from those organizations are coming onto Shaw's campus to teach classes, which is absolutely outstanding because I want them to learn about app development. You know, everything that is happening now in the industry, I want to ensure Shaw is providing
that
it.
That does lead to the challenge that any university head faces these days, and that is this balance between being a liberal, providing a liberal education, critical thought and all of that, and then training people to become employees, and a kind of worry that you can go too far down that path.
That is correct, and I think it's a good question. But before I answer that, I think what's important is that, you know, Shaw University has to focus on becoming the best Shaw it can be. Right now, that's in development. So I want to ensure that, you know, every student that comes on to our campus sees its value and is able to translate whatever tuition that they've poured into the university, they can translate that into getting a job and a return on investment. And that is what I have a stellar focus on right now, because I want to ensure that, you know, our students are going right back out into the marketplace and being able to serve in entities and being well prepared to compete globally.
Tashni, it has been a real pleasure talking to you. I want to ask you one last question that I put to every chemist on our show.
All right.
And that is, what is your favorite element on the periodic table?
Ah, that's a good question.
That's a great
one. That's the first time I've ever been asked that, actually.
So,
aye, aye, aye. For every woman, they probably say platinum, so we can have some jewelry and all of that. But let's see. I think carbon.
Carbon.
Yes, carbon. And simply because it is so intertwined with life. You know, it's the backbone of the benzene ring. And it's even, you know, a tune in the Bible, right? So I think that is what I have to say is my favorite.
You've made my day. Dr. Tashni DuBroy is president of Shaw University. And you can find out more about her and her career and Shaw University at our website, stateofthings.org. It's a program that's produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton Ormond, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.